to Death Hauler, Season 5, When Bad Animals Go Bad, with your hosts, the Reverend Dr. Death and Lyraina. This season will include love.
Do you know how your husband died?
Oh, yes. I killed him.
Transformations. And certified good boys and girls.
Cujo, what are you growling at?
Remember, when you're in Death Hauler, listener discretion is always advised.
Perfect, go bad, dang!
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Death Hauler. I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Death, and joining me as always is my co-host, Lyraina. We played with Cujo. We played with werewolves. Lyraina, are you ready to play with dead things?
Yes, and as I've heard in one of the movies we're going to review, sometimes dead is better. So, you know, it might be fun.
A lot of history on that road.
Shut up.
It's time for the belated birthday bash. We might have missed our annual June tradition, but damn it, we're going to make up for it this episode. By strange coincidence, Lyraina and myself picked two Stephen King movies as our favorites this go around. I chose the Bad Animal movie, and Lyraina picked the werewolf movie. Imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
So gas up your motorized wheelchair, grab a shovel or two, and follow us down a misty trail down to Pet Cemetery from 1989. I'm specifically making sure that you know it's that version. And Stephen King's Silver Bullet from 1985. If you're enjoying the podcast, we would appreciate it if you could take the time to like, comment, subscribe on whatever podcast platform you prefer. It helps us get more visibility on podcast listings and helps us grow. Also, consider following us on social media. You can find us on TikTok and Twitter under Death Hauler Pod, and we can be found on Instagram and Facebook under Death Hauler Podcast. We appreciate everyone who listens and hope you enjoy the show. First up, Pet Cemetery from 1989. And I'm putting this one first, not for preference myself, but because if we're going to end this whole thing, let's end it on an upbeat as opposed to an extreme downbeat. And that's all Pet Cemetery is. Spoiler alert. There's nothing good that happens in this movie.
Wait. Is that a reflection on your rating of the film or just in general how
No, it is. It's not my rating of the movie. It is if you're on the verge of self-deleting, as the kids say, you might not want to watch Pet Cemetery and definitely don't read the fucking book. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Oh, yeah. I had to warn the boyfriend because he is very new to the horror genre. Maybe I shouldn't say very new. He just wasn't as into it as we are. And that's okay. Like, you know, I'm converting him. He's got me watching anime and all kinds of things. So, you know, we're introducing things to each other. But that being said, he is very new to horror in comparison. And I just had to let him know, like, look, if you're having a hard time now, it's seriously going to get worse. And then something really bad happened that I know affects him. And I'm like, do you think this is the worst thing? Because I just want to give you one more warning that it actually does continue to get worse. It's not going to get better.
No, it's one bad thing after another. And we'll get into that, but it's just anybody who's never seen this movie or doesn't know what it's about other than the fact, oh, it's about you bury stuff in a cemetery and it comes back. There's more to it than that. I mean, there's nothing good that comes out of this cursed soil, as it were. So,
real quick though, doesn't the book kind of imply that some of the animals actually were good at first?
Some of them come back and they're not as severely cruel or mean or whatever as the ones in the movie. But okay. You're talking about, like, you know, I think there's like a rabbit that comes back and it's not as bad, but it's you know, just grades of, you know, like bad. It's not like it came back and it was perfect. I mean, it's, you know, and it does imply that whenever the dog comes back, like Judd's, you know, Judd's dog or whatever, whenever he was a kid, it was pretty much like a Cujo type situation. So yeah. Like it, even then it was bad. Like there's, and he knew, and we'll get into that too. Like, I mean, there's an argument even by the director that Judd's not a good man in this movie. You might want to look at him as like the kindly old, like neighbor that's like trying to look out for the family, but did he really?
We need we're definitely going to have to discuss that because it is for the first time, and I've watched this film hundreds of times. I did not need to rewatch this film at all for a review, but I did have the boyfriend watch it, and because I needed him to kind of see what we were reviewing, and it's always nice to have a refresher per se, but for the first time watching it again last night, I was like, I don't think Judd is a good person. And I even Googled what was his reasoning for blank. And we'll get into that.
Okay. Yeah, that's a discussion to be had because I never quite thought of it until this time either. And yeah. I was listening to the behind the scenes and I heard the director, which directed by Mary Lambert, were at that point in the show where we're kind of going through that stuff.
But, yes.
She has her opinion on that, and I don't disagree with her opinion, but nice. We'll get into it later. Written by Stephen King, and not just the book, but he also wrote the, you know, script play for this.
Nice.
Music by Elliot Goldenthal. Made for a budget of $11.5 million. It made $57.5 million, so it's one of the King movies that actually did really well at the box office.
Done did good.
Principal players. We have Dale Midkiff, who plays Lewis Creed. Doctor, father, and husband, and I want to say idiot, but if you were in his shoes and you were given the option, I don't know that you could turn it down. That's and that goes into discussion later with Judd. So, I mean, it's I don't know that I can blame the man. I did when I was younger, but the older I get, I'm like, and just even though I didn't never. Wasn't lucky enough to have children. Just the idea if I had and I'd been in his situation, I probably would have taken this deal.
I firmly disagree. Now, would I consider it for my children? Absolutely. I already have a demon child. You know, I'm good. I can handle it. But for the pets, I just don't think that.
I would have never taken it for the pets. Yeah, I'm talking about for Gage.
Okay, that makes sense because I was about to say.
I'm not as big of a animal lover as you are anyway, so I'm just going to throw it out there. I like them, but if it came to, are you going to spend $12,000 for the dog to have cancer treatment? It might get another month to live.
Yeah,
hell no, I'm not.
Yeah, and I'm with you on that.
I will take that money and give that to my wife if she needs it for some kind of similar thing because that's different. You know?
Exactly. Oh, 100%. Whatever. But I was thinking that, and I know that they did this because the movie had to happen. You can't, you have to have a little starting point, but to do it because it's like, oh, I can't explain death to my daughter. I thought that was fucking ridiculous.
Now, that was dumb. I don't disagree with that whatsoever.
So I think he is dumb. But anyways.
Actually, the death of a pet is the perfect time to teach a child about death because, I mean, it's so much harder for a relative, like grandparents and stuff like that. But, I mean, with a pet, it's a little bit easier to, you know, just kind of, you know, describe what's going on and stuff like that without having to get into religion and whether there's soul and, I mean, whatever, you know, like, you know, with a kid. So.
Yeah.
Denise Crosby plays Rachel Creed, wife, mother, and loaded with childhood trauma, and I don't blame her. If I had Zelda as a sister, I'd probably be dead, to be honest. She was in Dolly Dearest, which we have already covered in the previous season. And Deep Impact. And by the way, Dale was in Time Tracks TV series and The Crow Salvation. He's mostly been in TV, so like there weren't a lot of movies that he was in. Miko Hughes plays Gage Creed, who's a scary, scary toddler in this movie. And I got to give it to him. He is one of the best child actors in a movie.
He was in Full House for his age. Amazing.
Kid could barely speak. I mean, that's how young he was.
Yes. Barely speak. he had been acting. I had to look because I know he was in Full House and he was quite a young child in Full House. He kind of was there for, I think, 4 or 5 years he was on that show. So he grew up on that show as well. They started off really young. And then he, I was like, okay, how old was this kid when he started acting? Because he looked to be maybe 3 years old in this film at best. And he could have been a small three-year-old, but realistically, I think he was two. 2 years old. He started acting at 22 months old. So just short of being 2 years old.
Jeez. So he's probably most well known outside of this for Kindergarten Cop. And do you know what particular scene he's most remembered for now?
It was definitely one of the school scenes.
Yeah, it was the scene that would get you in trouble today on TikTok. Boys have penis, girls have vagina.
Yes.
You know, that will get you in trouble today. Sad as that is to say. Anyways.
Fortunately, he has not been canceled. Yeah.
Blaise Bernal plays Ellie Creed, a poor girl who sees dead people. And she sees a lot of Pascal, as she calls him, or what is Pascal. Pascal.
Yeah, Pascal. It is Pascal. It's Pascow.
Yeah, but she calls him Pascal.
Pascal, yeah.
She was in the Ghost Rider TV show, which I caught a little bit of whenever I was a kid, but like I vaguely remember it.
I could
it
never like get into PBS. It. It wasn't even scary.
No, it was like they just it wrote whatever and they had to respond to it in kind of like an investigation type situation. Yeah. Brad Greenquist plays Victor Pascal, who's the brainy ghost. I mean, he is a college student, but, you know, got the brains leaking out of his head the entire time. He was in Ali and then Water for Elephants.
Okay.
And I'm going to say this. The effects for Victor are amazing. Like, he is so disgusting as a ghost, like, the entire time that he's in the movie.
Oh, they did a great job with his effects for the 80s. Well, late 80s, but still.
Yeah. Of course, Fred Gwynn plays Judd Crandall. A lot of history on that road. Sometimes that is better.
I've never heard of this guy.
No. He wasn't the judge in My Cousin Vinny, and he definitely wasn't Herman Munster. Nobody knows him as
nobody,
that character.
Nobody, yeah. Whatsoever. Oh, my goodness.
As he drives down the road in his Dragula. Andrew Hubestek, yes, a man, and I'm reversing earlier, you know, I get in trouble with a certain crowd for saying the penis and vagina thing. Well, a man played Zelda in this movie, so there you go.
Yes.
You know, and this was the bane of my childhood. This fucking thing destroyed me as a kid. Like, my aunt showed me this movie at a way too young of an age, and the only thing I could remember that night wasn't Victor Pascal, it wasn't Gage. It wasn't any of the stuff in the movie. It was fucking Zelda. And like, every time she's in, even now when I see her, I'm just like, nope, get the fuck out of there. Rachel or whatever her name is, the sister. I'm like, get away from Zelda. I don't want her. I don't want to see her anymore. Just go.
I have a funny story about this scene because I saw this scene before I saw the rest of the movie. And what had happened was I was at the movie theater and we were getting ready to walk into a kid's film, mind you. And we walked into the wrong theater at the wrong time because this was the scene. And I was absolutely horrified. Now, I had no idea that it was Pet Sematary, so I did see it later and I realized, oh my God, this is the movie I was walking into by accident, you know. But yes, that happened to me and I was a kid.
This, to have that totally removed from the movie and not know where it came from, that would be even worse than being forced to watch the movie and knowing what what caused it. I mean, in my opinion, but.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm curious right now because I'm checking to see what we were trying to walk into. And here's a few of the films that were in theater at the same time as Pet Sematary. The Burbs was in the theater. I might have been trying to go see that. Say Anything. I don't think I was going to see that. Lethal Weapon 2, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Batman. I may have been going to see Batman. Born on the 4th of July and Major League. Those are some of the movies that were in the theater. So if I were to guess, it was probably Batman or The Burbs, more than likely Batman.
Can we just talk about how amazing that lineup was
of movies? Oh, man. I mean, shoot. We haven't reviewed The Burbs yet, huh? Because that's going to be human horror.
That's human horror, yes. But yes.
I mean, Say Anything, that is just a classic. Like, it is the, you know, romantic comedy film.
That's John Cusack, right?
Yes, it
is. That's the one where, is that the one that's got the boombox that he holds over it? Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Lethal Weapon 2, really, do we need... Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Do I even need to say anything about those? Batman, Tim Burton's Batman, like
Batman Returns, the one with Catwoman and, you know, Danny DeVito's Penguin, is the first movie I ever specifically watched in a sit down movie theater.
Mm-hmm. Born on the 4th of July. I've seen it. I wouldn't say I know it is like a classic.
I
wouldn't say it's anything that I'm like would constantly watch or, you know, like, oh yeah, I love that film. I just liked it, you know. And then Major League, that was the comedy one.
So. Major League is there's two movies for me that if you put them on TV, I will, no matter what part of the movie they're in, I will watch them the rest of the way through. It is Major League, maybe Major League 2, depending upon my mood.
Major League 2 is good,
And Face Off.
Yeah.
With Nick Cage, because that movie is so batshit insane when you get into it. Because when it's not only Nicolas Cage acting ridiculous in that movie, it's also John Travolta when he's acting like Nicolas Cage.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it just perfect.
Oh, my God. Anyway. Speaking of, I need to quick, and this is related to the show. I made the boyfriend watch Freaky.
Freaky?
Yes. And just how Vince Vaughn was acting like a teenage girl. Oh, he loved it.
If that girl from Supernatural was a better actress, that movie would be so much better.
Yeah,
she's the weak point of that movie. She honestly is.
You know, my favorite scene with her, though, I thought was amazing, was when she's walking down the hallway at school and they catch her and they're like, oh, my God, like, there he is. And she's like, help, help the murderer. And I was like, oh, you fucking asshole.
Now, I will give her this. I'm pretty sure that she's the main actress in Lisa Frankenstein, and she's actually good in that movie.
Okay, but you did say you liked
her. She's not in Freaky, so.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a real, also another thing, and this is a whole conversation we need to have because we need to let the viewers know what we thought about each individual, you know, HHNs. But the Blumhouse section for the RIP at Hollywood Horror Nights? No. It was awful. Fucking awful.
The Blumhouse scare zone they had last year was dog shit. It the only was, thing good about it was that they had a person playing I think it was somebody who was dressed up like Uncle Sam, like a Purge version of Uncle Sam.
Yeah,
like,
we had one of those.
Through. He was good, but everybody else was just kind of like, meh, you know, whatever. So.
Yeah, it was horse shit, so we'll move on from that. But, yeah, we need to have that conversation.
Oh, and speaking of that, since we're on the animal section of this episode, I did watch Good Boy in the theater.
Oh, yeah.
I highly recommend it. I mean, now, it's not scary, at least in my opinion, but I'm jaded. You know, it takes a lot to scare me, and if something scares me, then you might not want to watch it because apparently people got scared of Weapons, and that's a fucking comedy, people. I'm sorry, but Weapons is a goddamn comedy, and I'll die on that hill. That's what it is.
My autistic son agrees with you, so.
Who is it that agrees?
My autistic son.
Oh, okay. It gets a certain point in Weapons, just throwing that out there, where if you're not laughing, you didn't get the point of the movie. You just didn't, so. But anyways, Good Boy, I enjoyed it, and it's even better when you have the director after the movie because that's what he had in the theater. He thanked everybody for coming out and watching the theater, and he showed how they filmed it, and that's the cutest dog I've ever seen in my damn life. Aww. Like, I mean, that's truly a good boy in that movie. So,
okay, you know. Certified good boy. I like it.
All right, synopsis for this movie. When the Creed family moves to the main countryside from Chicago, they envision an idyllic life. That is, until they realize their house is near a road filled with high-speed semis and a creepy pet cemetery. Oh, did I mention that a Wendigo lives behind that cemetery and stalks the woods? Well, the old guy next door, Herman Munster, knows all about that. And instead of keeping his yap shut, he tells the distraught Lewis Creed all about how the Mi'kmaq Indian burial ground can bring back the dead. That'll go well, right? where nothing ever rests in peace. That's why you don't bury a human being there, not in your right mind. That is a tagline and is a long-ass tagline, just saying. Other taglines. Iconic terror from the number one best-selling writer.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of King movies that could pretty much be any of them. Don't forget to put out the cat before the cat puts out you. Mm. Were they watching the Flintstones? I mean, that's, you know, you remember that scene in the intro to Flintstones where he's trying to put the cat outside?
And it jumps in and puts him out?
Yeah. A magical place where a child's best friend can come back and live forever as an adult's worst nightmare. And if it works for animals, ..
No, that makes no sense. It sounds whimsical. It sounds like, oh, I want to watch this movie because it's magical.
Never-ending story. That's what it sounds like. Atreyu, home is where the horror is. That could be anything.
Yeah, and it could be anything.
A pet isn't just for life.
I kind of like that because it's like, if you have a scary picture of church on the front and it's like a pet isn't just for life, it's also for death is what I'm thinking next, you know?
But of course, sometimes dead is better, is much better with that cat on the front cover. I mean, that's what you go with. And of course, quotes Judd Crandall, sometimes dead is better, you know? Even though he doesn't agree with that statement, we'll get into that in a minute. Lewis Creed about the Indian burial ground. Has anyone ever buried a person up there? And Judd Crandall spills his drink. Christ on his throne, no, and whoever would. You lied, buddy, and then you go back and you won't keep your mouth shut. So Rachel finds her sister Zelda in the present. Rachel, is that you? I finally came back for you, Rachel. I'm going to twist your back like mine so you'll never get out of bed again. Never get out of bed again. Zelda, just die and never come back. Like, we don't need any more ghosts in this movie, and you're the worst, so just stay out of it.
Is she a ghost or is she a figment of the imagination?
It could go either way because, I mean, I feel like there's a lot of, and that's basically the point of this movie when you get right down to it, is that evil at every point is working against any of the heroes in the movie.
Yeah.
And Pascal does his best to stop everything that's happening, and he's always getting overridden by the Wendigo or whatever it is that's behind everything.
Yeah.
So, Lewis answers the phone to talk to the reanimated Gage. I'm at Judd's, Daddy. Will you come over and play with me? First, I play with Judd. Then Mommy came, and I played with Mommy. We play, Daddy. We have an awful good time. Now I want to play with you. That is very creepy in that movie, by the way.
That kid is creepy in general.
Lewis returns home after burying Rachel. Judd Crandall narrating, the soul of a man's heart is stonia, Lewis. A man grows what he can and he tends to it because what you buy is what you own, and what you own always comes home to you.
Oh, you forgot a quote.
Yeah.
That's my daughter's cat. That's your cat now.
No, yeah, that's your cat now.
That was and I forgot about that. And I put my hands over my mouth and I was like, oh, and the boyfriend's like, what? And I was like, that is his cat now. Like
he brought it back, so it belongs to him. Visuals. Pascal is so gross looking. I mean, he's a better zombie than most zombie movies we reviewed. Just saying.
Yeah,
he really is.
Well, and to be fair to other zombie films, although some of them look like they flat out just didn't even try, he was the only one they really had to focus on other than Zelda.
That is true. But in good zombie movies, they always have the hero zombies that they put the most effort into that look super good, like Bub.
Yes.
And then the rest of them, they kind of like, oh, we'll slap a little blue makeup on you or whatever it is. You
know? Maybe add a little green. That'll help.
I don't feel like church, they didn't really did a whole lot for, because when they brought him back, the way that they explained that he died, they didn't really have to show him like disgusting or anything. And it wouldn't make sense for the story either, because the girl had to buy that he didn't die or anything. So she could notice the smell, but she didn't really couldn't tell that he was dead. So they didn't really have to do anything with the cat. He was just, you know, like, I mean, they did a lot of stuff with the eyes glowing, but it's pretty easy to film that. You just have to put like a light in their eyes and let that reflective, you know, surface that they've got kind of play back. Gage didn't really have much to him either. He had a little bit of dark makeup under his eyes to make him, you know, like a little bit more dead looking, a little bit paler than he was. Now, Rachel, when she comes back and she's got the gross shit coming out of her face as she's like smooching with Lewis, That's pretty bad. Perfection. Yeah, that's pretty bad.
The eyeball oozing. Yep. Absolute perfection.
If they would have went more with the book and they probably didn't have the budget to do this, I think Gage should have been more disgusting looking too, because he had moss growing on him whenever Lewis dug him up.
Which
King
makes
goes
sense.
Through this whole detailed explanation of just how much rot that kid has already started to suffer before Lewis ever digs him up. And it's bad.
And it makes sense because they made the house look mossy and rotted who was walking through? The dad. When the dad was walking through, and he's like, I scared you, didn't I? Because obviously it went away. And if they couldn't for time or for budget or whatever, they just didn't want to do it to the kid. At least they brought a sense of it in with by doing it to the house.
That's true. They did. They showed the rot in the house since the death of Judd. Now they did good with him, like how they cut his, you know, Achilles tendon or whatever. and then they cut his mouth. That was pretty good.
Yes.
I'm going to throw a negative in here, though, and it is visual scene. When Lewis is walking through the house and Gage, like, leaps down from the rafter or from the attic to try to attack him, that is the funniest fight. He looks like a flying squirrel, the way that they filmed it.
And he looks like it was very Chucky-like, which wasn't that around the same time frame, roughly?
Chucky was a few years before, but yeah, it was. Or wait, maybe Chucky was only like a year before. So yeah, it was very Chucky-ish. You got a little bit of the midget actor going on with that. I mean, and it's understandable, but it look. Let's just say in 4K, it doesn't. It looks even worse than it did back in the day.
What was I gonna say? It's okay, because visually you're right, there were things that probably could have been slightly better, but the actors brought it to life, and that does not exclude the cat. That cat was trained amazingly, and I guess this goes under acting. We'll get there, but
yeah,
I think I am going back to visual. This coincides with visual because they made it scary. That kid's not rotten looking face, but his little shit face he had when he's attacking the person with the fucking knife, you know, or the scalpel. Yeah.
Well, and of course, Zelda, we can't leave that out because, I mean, that's still horrifying looking to this day. And
it holds up.
And I'll give them credit for this because this is under visuals. The cemetery itself, creepy as fuck. They did a good job with that. Just the good one, the one where the animals stay dead.
Yes.
And then the scenes behind it, the area that they scouted out to be like the Mi'kmaq cemetery. It's both beautiful and haunting at the same time, which is what it was supposed to have been.
Yes.
Because they get those big vistas in the background, you know, where you can see like the forest for miles, and they're on top of that big like stony plateau and everything.
Yeah.
They did a good job scouting that area.
I think they did great. Yeah. So visually, I would say for the film in 1989, almost everything held up.
Yeah. I mean, and since Pascal is the, the hero ghost in the movie, the fact that he stands up every time he's on screen is a major win for the movie, because if that didn't look good, then none of the rest of it was going to look good.
True. Is he getting worse in every scene, or was I imagining that?
I kind of feel like, I think you just get to a point where you start noticing more and more about him because it's so sudden when he first pops up that it's almost like with Lewis, you're in shock at like what you're seeing with him because of his brains leaking out and everything. And the more that he's on screen, the more you fixate on him.
Yeah.
And you see more and more of like how much damage he actually took whenever he was, because when he hit by a car, which is, if I'm remembering right, he was hit by a vehicle, which is basically foreshadowing what's going to happen to Gage.
Yeah, and we'll probably have to talk about this a little bit later, but I didn't notice, Antonio noticed it, but did you know that the same trucker that hit Gage was the same trucker that picked up the mom?
I did not notice that.
I didn't. He had to point it out to me, and thankfully they go back to it and they show it, and I was like, it fucking is.
I will say this, and this is another thing that should have been gross about Gage, but I get it. They couldn't really do much with Miko. He was too young to put a lot of makeup on him. Gage was knocked out of his sneakers to the point that there were still feet in them in the book.
Okay, and granted, they just left it kind of bloody looking on the shoe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His feet were still in his sneakers in the book. That's how hard he got hit.
And I don't know if I'm saying this word properly. Is that anatomically, like, possible?
I think there is. I don't know with a truck, but there is history of people getting literally knocked out of their shoes to the point that their feet stay where they're at. Like,
okay.
I mean, they're, you know, based upon like where they get hit and how they get hit. I mean, and he was small enough to where it wouldn't have, like the bulk, it could probably work that way. But King was in a bad place when he wrote this book. He shelved this book for years before he ever, and his wife was the one that was like, you might want to put that out. And he's like, I don't think anybody should read this.
Sir, you had childhood rape or orgies in another book. Calm the fuck down.
Well, it is, if you read it, it is, I mean, it's more dark and disturbing than this movie is. I read it, and I mean, especially when you get to the point where Lewis is breaking down and you're with him, like, yes, mentally, it's bad. It's really bad.
How old were you when you read this book?
I was in high school.
I was probably either end of elementary school or junior high. I don't know. I had no business reading this book. I don't remember a chunk of it, and I'm thinking maybe there's a reason.
There probably is. I mean, okay. You know, but yeah, it's pretty bad. So, I mean, I get where he's coming from, but I agree with you on the other side of it. But also, people pointed this out, he had editors. They could have written out the orgy scene in it at any point in time. And somebody was just like, you know, that's a good idea. It's like, okay. All right. Somebody's in the grooming, just saying, you know.
Yeah, I feel like that's just a thing that's not going to go away. But
moving on, though, story-wise, let's get into it about Judd. The female director, Mary Lambert, said, and I agree with her on this, if Pascal is the good angel on Lewis's shoulder trying to steer him in the right direction, Judd is the devil. He doesn't mean to be necessarily, but he is, because he tempts Lewis every fucking time that Lewis could have went a different way. He gives him something that tips the man over, like, you know, like giving an alcoholic some beer.
Do you want to know what I found in my research? What I think that I found in my research.
What's that?
There's two things that say, why did Judd do what he did to introduce basically Lewis to the Pet Sematary? One of them was simply just to keep the storyline going. That's how the movie moves along. Okay, I'll buy that. That's an easy answer. The more complex answer I got, and the one that seems to make the most sense, is Judd had been introduced to the Pet Sematary when he decided to bury his dog there. He had possibly heard about it prior with the one person that was buried there, or he probably did it before. I don't exactly remember in the story how Judd knew about it, but we know that he buried his dog there. His dog came back to life. He had to put his dog down and bury him in the regular Pet Sematary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that happened. They say that once you are introduced to it, the spirits call on you and they'll do whatever it takes to bring you back. So while Judd tried to have good intention, he constantly also has a bad spirit on his shoulder. That's like
the Wendigo was drawing him back.
Exactly. Now, Judd specifically says in the movie, it's my fault that this happened to Gage. I introduced you to that damn place, you know, with church, and now, you know, it wants more. He's introduced him. So now, you know, what's his name? Why can't I think? Not Judd.
Lewis.
Lewis is introduced, and now they're calling on him and causing reason for him to have to put more, I guess, vessels there for them to inhabit.
The movie does support that to a certain degree, because two things in the movie. Mm-hmm. The Rachel's car breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
Which stops her, even though Pascal has done everything in his power to divert her back to get to Lewis before he buries Creed.
Yes.
He's trying his best to get her back there because she would be a voice of reason.
Yes.
The car breaks down. she has to take a ride with a trucker, you know, that you said was, you know, linking back was one that killed Gage. That's another bad sign. Mm-hmm. And so the Wendigo intervened there. Judd, in his lucid moment, is trying to wait up to catch Lewis before he goes to the cemetery because he senses that something bad's going to happen.
Yes.
And he goes to bed.
Yes.
He's sitting there sleeping on his front porch, you know, so the Wendigo, you know, caused him to miss it. And so there is influence there from the Wendigo. Like, it is working against everybody in the movie.
Yes. So kind of tying everything in, if all this is to be true, or even if it's just to be inferred, this story is really good. Everything ties in together so well. There's even other theories that can tie in together with this, no matter how bad they are.
Yeah, I mean, the notion that Judd is a doom prophet that actually instigates the doom, that right there is enough in of itself mm-hmm. to kind of, you know, make it stand out. He's not like Crazy Ralph in the Friday the 13th movie and just like, you know, he's going to kill you. He's going to kill y'all. No, Judd, he introduces the doom.
Yes.
He's like, don't go up there. But wait, Lewis, there's a solution. Let's go up there.
Yeah. But wait, there's more.
But wait, there's more. And even there's even a moment. There is even a moment. There's foreshadowing throughout this entire movie. Judd's walking up that pile, and you know, Lewis is concerned. He's like, hey, we can't get up there. And he's like, I know the way. He's like, just step in the place I tell you. And Lewis falls. So that was either A, the good side trying to pull him back and keep him from going up there to begin with, or that was foreshadowing that of his own eventual fall in the movie, however you want to look at it.
Do you remember in the book why they weren't supposed to look down?
I know at one point in time they see the Wendigo, if as you know, like that scene, because they hint at this in the movie, but they didn't have the budget for it, and I'm glad they didn't try to show it. But when Judd's like, when they're walking up there and Lewis hears something, Judd tells him, shut up, don't mm-hmm. say anything.
Yeah.
The Wendigo is close to them at that moment in yes. time. Like, it's right there.
Oh, very much inferred. In the book, the reason why they weren't supposed to look down, and Judd told him not to look down either, is because they're actually walking on air.
That is right.
They're not walking on anything. So, yes, I do think that I like your theory that, oh, that's the good, because I felt that way too, but then I was remembering the book and I was like, oh, wait a second. They weren't supposed to look down, and specifically, Lewis said, oh, I lost my happy thoughts, inferring Peter Pan. You know, you have to think happy thoughts to fly. But they are technically floating. So while they didn't do it, probably budget-wise, they couldn't make it look good, or they just didn't want to go that route. Whatever the reason being, it still kind of kept it in the story of, I looked down, so I fell. And if they looked kinda down,
kind of like the Looney Tunes logic. Yes. It's like you can run on air until you realize you're on air, and then when you realize that, then you fall.
There you go. Yes.
Now, I do wish, in a way, because it's just such a harrowing scene in the book, that they could have shown just how much Lewis, how bad his mental state was, and how bad it was for him to dig up Creed or Gage at the time that he did, because that in that book, whenever I read that scene, like, it literally felt like it lasted longer than any other thing in the book, just because he's just manic at that point. Like, his mind is gone, like, completely. There's no helping him at that moment. And when he's sitting there and he's like, just literally, like, you know, like, smoothing down his decaying son's head, and like moss and like rotted skin is coming off in his hand. Like, if they could have shown that, like, that would have been, I mean, it would just completely cemented how bad this whole situation was. But I get that they couldn't have. They showed I will say this, the actor Dale, who played him in that scene when he's in the grave and he's like trying to hide from the police, and then he's like furiously going back to, he does give the manic part of it. He does a good job in that scene. Like,
yeah.
And actually, I'll argue this for him. He starts out as a weak actor, in my opinion, at the beginning of this movie. This goes into acting slightly. Mm-hmm. But by the end of the movie, he is one of the strongest people in the movie because he sells that desperation.
Yeah. He does.
I feel like
he could have been more desperate.
Fred starts out stronger, yes. But I don't feel like he progresses any. He kind of stays where he's at. But Dale, like you get more and more of him toward the end of the movie, and he sells that character just like going through it.
Yeah.
But yeah, story wise, Judd is he really is the bad guy in the movie. Like you can argue all you want to. I used to think as a kid, it's like, oh, he's trying to warn him, he's trying to prevent it. But he does. If you go back and watch the movie, it's because of him. Like if he would have never offered that, mm-hmm. and there was no reason to offer that for the fucking cat.
There wasn't.
And I'll say this. This goes in this area too, slightly. It's in between visuals and story. That's rough watching him, Lewis, put that cat down.
The second time.
Well, I guess he didn't put him down. He injects it, and then the cat's sitting there, and it's rough to watch.
Yes. Now, do you have any trivia on that? Like how they accomplished that?
Yeah, they actually gave it like a real sedative, and they had a vet there. They were watching it. So, I mean, it was all safe and everything, but they really did give it a sedative. So
I figured as much. That's what it totally looked like to me. I thought they did a great job. I mean, are they allowed to do that now? Is that considered abuse? I don't feel like it is.
I mean, you can give, animal sedatives for different things. So, I mean, I don't know that it would be, but it borders on being because the cat probably didn't need it.
That's true. So, I don't know. Acting wise, I just want to throw it out there. That cat was amazing.
it stands out as one of the biggest, when I think of when bad animals go bad, I think of Church.
Oh,
I really yes, do.
Absolutely. And the thing of it is too, and you'll have to tell me in trivia, and you may or may not know, I know in the remake they had like two or three different Maine Coons.
They had several cats in this one, yeah.
Okay, and I kind of figured that they did. And
I will say this is trivia for that movie, just up front. There's a picture on the internet of whenever they took that cat to the premiere, one of the cat's premiere, and they had like a fancy like bow tie on it. And the cat leaned in to the picture. It was like, it's the cutest thing ever.
And I, I have some updates that particular actor cat passed away.
Oh,
very
that's sad.
Suddenly. And it was, And now granted, I think the same people that train basically those Maine Coons, they have others that are still acting, and everything. But that one. Probably, and I believe he was the main actor cat of that film.
The main Maine Coon,
yes. But anyways, moving forward.
We're in acting now. Yes. I will say this, the little girl does a decent job, especially toward the end whenever she's really distraught and she's worried about Lewis. She, just like Dale does, like that actor that plays her, gets better as the movie goes on, because I feel like both of them are kind of stiff and kind of like they kind of like just, like TV actors at first. And then you actually see them come out and do better at the end of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, she was very annoying, but that just means she was doing her job very well.
Yeah.
The Gage Miko, that child actor, holy crap. Like, how do you find out your child is a good actor at that age?
I don't know. And to get a kid, I realize this, that there's ways around this, because going back to where I was talking about Good Boy, obviously the dog was not an actor. I mean, that you can get online. The director of the movie is also the main star of the movie. And the reason he did that was because it was his dog.
Yes.
And he knew that he would have that chemistry there. And you see it in the movie. It's all over the movie. But whenever they were filming the movie, he does this thing, and I'm sure you do this with young children like this too, where you film a scene in a certain way, and if you were watching it being filmed, it was just like, what the fuck are you doing? But when you frame it with editing and stuff, it makes it different.
Yes.
Like in the instance of Good Boy, they're filming a scene that's real scary where the dog's like looking at a window, and like in the scene, like something like the window or the curtain like forms a body comes out of, like the curtain, like there's a presence there.
Yes.
And the dog has looked like it's scared. When they showed that actual scene being filmed, the director was standing over atop the dog and he had like a little duck on his hand and he was like, quack, quack, yeah. quack, quack. And he filmed the scenes around it and gave the context that the mind fills in. So I'm sure the same thing happens with such a young actor as Miko. Like they were probably doing things off screen with like little toys and stuff to get him to act a certain way. But at the same time, just the way that they got him to say some of the stuff, like either through editing or his own acting ability, and I think it's a combination of both, yes. probably, it really worked out.
I like the scenes where he's got the scalpel in his hand, it's raised up, and he's just got this menace look on his face, and I'm like, good God, like, we have seen some horrible children actors, so to see something like this at such a young age is very impressive.
Yeah, I watched Frailty today as part of my Halloween, movies. And those kids start off a little weak too, but they're pretty good in that movie. Those two kids in Frailty are pretty damn good.
Oh my God, the shit that they have to go through. That movie is something else.
God told me to do it. What are you talking about, Fenton? That is a human horror movie that we will be covering for sure. But anyways, so the other actor we've not covered yet as far as acting is the mom. How'd you feel about her? I feel like she did decent. Enough to kind of keep it going.
Yeah, I mean, especially in her traumatic scenes, because at first she was just kind of there and you're just like, she's such a fucking granola mom, you know? But then she gets to express herself and what she thought about death and everything and how she was feeling about everything. And I was like, okay, like I didn't want anything more from her or anything less. It was just perfect, you know?
Yeah, I feel like she evened out, you know, the cast enough to where it didn't attract, so everything else, you know, gelled around her.
Yes.
You know, perfectly fine. Music-wise, score, there's nothing, there's maybe one or two pieces of this movie where they give a hint of some kind of like happiness just to dash it in the next scene. Oh, like literally 100%. That's what they do.
Yeah. It's like, like, oh shit.
Cause I mean that overall thing that it gets back to my original point about this movie, there is nothing good that happens in this movie.
Oh,
not to say the movie's bad, but like literally it's like this family moves here. They think they're going to have this great life in the country. They lose their cat, whatever that could have been, you know, the end of it. But no, they lose their son, terrible. And then just it keeps spiraling from there.
Oh,
like
yeah.
One family member after the next, everybody in the immediately like just every main character dies except for the little girl. And the only reason that she's saved is because she's off in Chicago away from all of it.
But for how long?
Yeah, that's the point. Like,
yes,
when Lewis and Rachel, because it's hinted at the end of the book that Rachel takes Lewis back up to the cemetery. Her decaying body takes him back up there to bring him back. So whenever they come back, yeah, the daughter's going to be next. That's all there is to it.
Oh, my God. That or say the grandparents are just like, oh, no, like, let's go. Let's check this out first. Like, honey, go check on her. Make sure our daughter's okay. Grandma stays home. Dad goes, he's next. Now a phone call's made. You need to come down here.
Yeah, I mean, because it literally is a movie where there's no, I mean, the hero loses. Pascal's the only hero, true hero in this movie, and he's already dead to begin with.
Yes.
And he just loses. I mean.
Yes, but hear me out. Like, okay, why towards the end was he no longer allowed to help? Like, why was there an end of the road for him?
The only thing I can think of is that, and this is tough because King is very anti-religious, which is a whole issue I have with him. Like, I mean, we'll get into it in the next movie specifically because of, you know, how it rolls out.
Yes.
But anybody with any kind of God religion in King's eyes is usually somebody to be distrusted or somebody who's evil. Yeah, I mean, it's across the board. Look at The Mist. The worst person in The Mist besides the monsters is Mrs. Cormandy or whatever her name is, who's the religious zealot that causes everybody to go crazy. So I don't know if that was his statement that, like, that Pascal had served his purpose according to God and he was being called on to, like, his final rewards finally, that he could actually move on because he had tried. The only reason he was still there, if you want to think in ghostly terms, is because I watched Casper today too. You know, they can't move on if they have something that's holding them there. If the thing holding him there was that he felt like he owed Lewis for trying to save his life, well, he done everything in his power that he could. And at that point he knew it was too far gone. Like he could not interact anymore.
Well, in my case where, you know, whenever I've had dreams, energy is required and you can only, there's more energy in almost evil and anger than there is in good for the most part. And that's not just anything I've ever dreamt of. That is, you know, it's in TVs as well, like shows. It's been in shows as well. Supernatural is a pretty good example of that. And that's why they try to usher them off to heaven, because the more they're on earth, you know, if they haven't passed over, they become angry and then they become powerful because of the anger, et cetera. So,
and there's some lore other than Supernatural that says the longer they're here, the more they lose their humanity, yes, which causes them to become more evil in that sense. Yes. So,
you know, malevolent, whatever. But so that being said, yes, he didn't really have any energy to go off. Nothing good was really happening. Yes, he had, for the most part, served his purpose to the best of his ability. And as for, well, okay, then why is the bad doing so good? Well, they are willingly, they have people, willing participants, that are bringing them energy. Here, please take this. And they're like, thank you. Come again, you know? And so that's my reasoning or my thought behind it as to, like, what, in terms of the bad side. On the good side, I was like, I don't understand, but I'm kind of explaining it to myself, literally, like, well, there's only so much you can do. Nobody is giving him any energy at all.
Yeah, the only person who's even, like, he's able to feed off whatsoever is Ellie, or whatever the girl's, you know, the young girl's name is, and he knows that she can't influence anything other than the fact of, you know, like, telling her mother.
Yes.
And once the mother gets set on that path, that's the most he can do.
Yes. You know? So, I mean, at least he had that. Interesting, he picked the dreamer.
Yeah, the one person who dreams all the stuff.
Yeah.
And that's also interesting. That's how he interacts with Lewis most of the time is when he's sleeping, because that's when they supposedly can. Now, I do have a question for you on this. This is outside the movie, just speculation. When you bury somebody in that cemetery up on the hill, does that prevent their spirit from going on to a peaceful afterlife? I feel like it does.
I believe it does, because you have willingly given not just their... I mean, unless it's just a vessel that you've given them, but they remember things.
It can't be a vessel, because just like you were getting ready to say, the memories they have, but also you don't get something anytime there's magic involved or just the law of nature. You don't get something for nothing. Energy has to be converted. So the only thing that could be converted is their actual soul.
Yeah,
into this undead thing.
And it's insane, because you're thinking about it. You didn't just give their body; you gave their soul away. Here's the thing. Do you have the right to do that? Because even evil has rules, you know. They didn't invite them in. Church didn't. I mean, with animals it might be different, but like Gage didn't willingly give himself up. He was given, and granted it was by a, you know, a protector, a person, but it's like, I didn't choose this. And I'm like, even in that realm, there's rules that have to be applied, you know? Because if, let's just say that is a thing where, okay, you didn't give yourself up, that means there's a loophole. That means you have a way to get out of that, because you didn't sign the contract.
In a good universe, that would be the case. I don't know that the universe of Pet Sematary is a good one.
No, definitely, yes.
But yeah. I think about that stuff sometimes, because there's an episode of Black Mirror that a lot of people hold as being like one of the few good episodes in the sense, not good in like critique wise, but good in the sense of like, it's got a good ending in theory, and I don't think it does. It depends on your worldview. It's the San Junipero. I don't know if you remember
you
this.
Told
if
me
you've
about
ever watched
this one.
That. But basically, the gist of the episode, and I'm spoiling this for people. I'm sorry, but that's what it is. You can go into a video game simulation of basically whatever you want. In this particular instance, is like 1980s, like California, San Junipero, and you can basically live your life there. Like you, whatever bad your life is on the outside, you can live this idyllic life in whatever time period you want. The concept behind the series, the ultimate concept, is that there's this woman and she ends up meeting the love of her life. And of course, it's, you know, it's Netflix, so it's a female. Mm-hmm. She was married at one point. Now this woman's old. This woman, but in the video game, she's young again. She's 20 something. The woman she falls in love with is actually chronically ill herself and is bedridden. But in the game, she's perfectly fine too.
Yeah.
But the woman was previously married to a man, had children. The man has died, and she has the option at the end of the story to die naturally or have her brain loaded into the simulation to live forever with her new lover. She chooses to live forever in this guaranteed heaven, quote mm-hmm. unquote, as opposed to trusting that when she dies, she'll go to the heaven that her husband always believed in and would be with him.
Yes.
Frankly, the idea of that scares the fuck out of me.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if you really think about it, because, A, what if it gets hacked?
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
And it turns into a hell for all eternity. B, is that really your essence? And C, do you want to be in an unending version of what you think heaven should be, or do you want to be in what heaven could be? Like, we have limited, that kind of gets into this whole thing, too, going back to what you were saying about, you know, like their souls can't move on and all that. If you trap them here, we know what this is like, and that's comforting in a way to know, but sometimes that is better. Sometimes the things we don't know are better than what we currently have. We just don't, I mean, we've never experienced them yet. So, and that's where faith comes into it.
The way I look at it is when you're exhausted and you've done a lot and you just want to lay down and you finally get to lay down and you get that relief, all I'm going to say is it's called they laid them down to rest for a reason. Whether or not your soul comes back in another life and you have to do life all over again in a different vessel is beyond me. But I feel like there is a period of rest, even if that were true. Or maybe when you're laid to rest, you are actually laid to rest. I think maybe some people come back to do it over again, but I think for the most part, you're laid to rest and you need to do that. And if I had the choice, I wouldn't have chose to been in the world forever because how many fucking days are there, you know? I'm not thinking about ending or nor do is that something that it appeals to me at all. But like when it's over, good night.
Well, it's one of those things where it kind of depends on I feel like the person and how stunted of growth they had as a person, because if you've tried to live your life the best that you can, you've not like, you know, you don't have a lot of regrets. You don't have a lot of like, I should have done this, should have done that.
Yeah.
And you get to the end of your life and, you know, most of the people that you truly cared about and loved are have moved on, mm-hmm. whether, you know, they're completely gone if you're, you know, atheistic or they're somewhere in another place that you, you know, could theoretically get to. Why would you want to linger here? You continuously, every time you lose somebody that you truly care about, a little piece of you goes away. At a certain point, you just want to, you want to rest. Your heart wants to rest, if nothing else.
Like I said, when it's over, good night.
So it's just, it's one of those things where anytime that, and I also think this brings back, there's the best thing that Buffy ever did, the TV show. She died in, I can't remember what season it was, maybe the fifth season, something like that. Mm-hmm. Willow brings her back. There's a whole arc there that season where Buffy's off and nobody can tell what's wrong with her. And then they have the musical episode. And the musical episode's probably one of the best episodes, if you're going to do a musical, that the show had. But the best part is at the end of it, she literally, because she has to tell the truth, like that's part of the demon's thing. She looks at him and she's like, what you all don't realize is I was in heaven. I had lived my life. I had done what I was supposed to do, and you brought me back to this place. Yeah. I was in a better place, and your selfishness put me back in basically hell.
Yeah.
So thank you for this, you know, and I think about that a lot because, like, I mean, we can grieve the people that have moved on, but we should also, you know, I mean, think, well, maybe they've got it better than us.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. It's just, it's stuff like this that, cause I mean, you're trapping the soul in the, I mean, in this body, you know, in this movie, at yes. least, and that's my opinion. And it's also, it goes from like even being a healthy body to a rotting one. So what are you really, I mean, it's almost like a commentary on grief being so selfish to the point that you cannot let the person rest.
Exactly.
That's really what this story's about.
Oh yeah.
So, I mean, kind of a scary thought, but it is a human, very human thing. Trivia of this, there's a little bit of this. Stephen King once mentioned that the only novel he wrote that really scared him was this. The role of Zelda, Rachel's terminally ill sister, was played by a man. The director, Mary Lambert, wanted Zelda and her scenes to frighten the audience, but did not believe that a 13-year-old girl was scary, so she cast Andrew Hubetzik in the role to make something be off about Zelda.
Nice.
Yeah, but you say that, and it's a male played a female, and I could see certain people nowadays being like, what do you mean off? You know, calm down. Calm yeah. down. It's not, they didn't mean it that way. I know you took it that way, but they didn't mean it that way. Mary Lambert tried getting Blaise Bardot to cry for a scene by suggesting the young actor think back on something from her life that was very sad, but the girl had nothing. Lambert instead ended up offering her more money if she'd cry.
Wow. Okay. That's what I'm talking about.
The original screenplay featured the Wendigo, a Native American demon that was mentioned in the novel, but it was ultimately cut from the film. Its presence is implied only twice. First in the scene where Lewis is walking through the woods at night and hears something large knock down a tree, and second when Judd first takes Lewis up to the Indian burial ground. There is a loud crash deep in the forest followed by a long, almost feminine howl, and Judd says that it's only a loon, but it's clear that he does not believe that himself.
Oh, yeah.
Since cats are difficult to train, they ended up using 9 cats. They gave them different jobs. One
Fuck
was a jumper,
yeah.
one was a snarler, and one was a cuddler. No cats were harmed during the filming. The original ending was more sad and quiet and emotional, but early screenings convinced them that the film needed a punchier one.
Okay.
Stephen King was present on location for most of the shooting of the film. The area it was shot was only 20 minutes away from his home in Bangor, Maine. The house is in Hancock, Maine, about 45 minutes south of Bangor. So nice. There you go. Bruce Campbell was the first choice for Lewis Creed. That would have been, I don't know. I like Bruce, but I don't know if he could have pulled off that kind of character.
I don't think so either. Everyone would have expected Ash, and he would have given Ash, and it's just not for this right here.
Even if he didn't give Ash, people would have been upset at him. It's like, what are you doing? Like, you're a badass. And it's like, that's not who Lewis Creed is. He's literally a broken man. Like, I mean, if you're going to go for Ash of any of the movies with Bruce Campbell, it's literally Evil Dead 1, the one that's the weakest, the one that is, you know, that would have been the only Ash that would have been close to Lewis, and he still would have been right for the role. So,
yeah.
Twin actresses played the role of Ellie Creed. Blaise Bardot, however, was mainly credited for the role, while Bo Bardot, Oliver, is credited as Ellie Creed too.
Interesting.
Pet Sematary was director Mary Lambert's second feature film. She's better known for directing music videos, especially for Madonna, including Material Girl and Like a Prayer. Although her work in the music industry, Lambert was friends with the Ramones, who were one of Stephen King's favorite bands. She approached them about recording a song for the film, and that's why we get the song I Don't Want to Be Buried in Pet Sematary at the closing of the end credits.
Nice.
According to Lambert, one of the hardest things to get the cat to eat was a pork chop. I don't know why, but there you are. Actor Brad Greenquist said in an interview that while in his gruesome makeup for the role of Victor Pascal, no one would sit with him while he was having lunch.
Wow.
That's a common thing in zombie movies, too. When the zombies are all eating lunch together, nobody wants to be around them. I get it, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't be a fan.
Stephen King required the movie to be filmed in Maine and its screenplay to be followed rigorously. So there you go. The original cut of the film delivered to Paramount's executives was judged to be too long, so excess footage had to be removed. They also decided the closing scene was too lame or too tame, and the request was to reshoot it to be more graphic. That's why we get the ooze coming out of her eye.
Hell yeah.
Initially, Paramount executives wanted a pair of twins to play the role of Gage, like those chosen to play Ellie, which was the more cost-effective option. However, Mary Lambert was very impressed with Miko Hughes, who was 2 years old.
Fucking shit, yeah.
who she felt was a natural talent despite his young age, so she lobbied the studio to accept her choice.
Great good, choice.
Good choice. director Mary... I'll go back one. When Stephen King first wrote the manuscript for Pet Sematary, he shelved it. It was only when his wife, Tabitha King, told him to publish it that he found it later and read through it. Stephen King then decided to take it to his publisher, same publisher that, you know, was over the orgy scene in King's It. Director Mary Lambert said that Fred Gwynne was her first and only choice for the role of Judd Crandall. Fred is, he's iconic in this scene so much that South Park, you know, made one of their best characters, basically this character from this movie. And there's even a section of their game, the Fractured But Whole, that they set it in like a haunted summer camp for like the handy capable. And Butters is going there at one point at the beginning of it, where the main character is, and, you know, and you pass by Judd and he's being the Doom Prophet again, you know, like he's warning you not to go to the camp because bad stuff's happening there. So, and I'm going to say this up front. This is a spoiler for the new one coming. The one we will eventually do at the end of the season, which is the remake. I don't think John Lithgow holds a candle to Fred Gwynne.
Okay, yes, but, I mean, I think John Lithgow unofficially was iconic in his own way.
He tried his best. Mm-hmm. There are things I like the idea of in that movie, but it's knowing that Fred Gwynne put in such a good performance as Judd, it really is hard for somebody else to fall in those shoes.
I agree. But I also didn't hold those standards for any of the characters. And I'm glad I did that, because you had expectations in that film and it didn't go the way, whether good or bad, it didn't go the way you would expect. Which one particular one was very awesome that it didn't go that way. And others was like, okay, well.
I actually, in my head canon, it's an alternate reality version of this movie because of that particular switch.
Yes.
That they did.
Yes. So, you know, yeah.
I try that with some movies. Like, I'll give Skarsgård this. I like his Pennywise in different ways
100%.
Than Tim Curry's.
He's not Tim Curry. You cannot hold them to the standard of the original. You will be let down.
But I haven't said that. There is something so creepy yet, like you could imagine it being like your just best old neighbor, like chummy neighbor, and how Fred portrayed this character that I do not get at all from Lithgow.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't. Anyways. One of the hardest elements for this production team was the path to the cemeteries. It was described as shining with moonlight.
That actually looked really cool. I thought that I did get that when I was watching the film.
They did a good job. It's just it was the hardest thing for them to try to get. Now, this would have been cool. George Romero was set to direct this, but when the filming was delayed, he had to drop out because Mary Lambert stepped in because he went on to direct Monkey Shines at the same time.
Pretty cool.
I would have liked to seen a Romero version of this movie, to be perfectly honest. Yeah. But, I mean, Lambert did a good job. Fred Gwynne said that he put his character on like a pair of overalls.
Literally.
The effort to cast Zelda began with little girls, but they were all just too sweet. The thinner they were, the sweeter and more appealing they were, Lambert said. She eventually thought to cast the boy in the role that would be more into the idea of looking ugly and coughing and spitting up and retching. She also thought it'd be creepier. She was right.
Oh, 100%. That was a very good call.
Mary Lambert spoke about the creepy painting. Paintings like that are a big part of early American portraiture because there's such a high mortality rate amongst infants. They didn't have photography back then, so a lot of people had portraits painted of their children after they died so they could remember them. Since so many died before the age of 2 and 3, those paintings were so frightening to me.
Okay, and did you notice anything in the paintings at all? Did you notice one particular painting?
I did not look at the paintings this time, no.
Oh, God damn it. Okay, towards the end, specifically when... the mom was calling to speak, The mom was calling to speak to, why can't I remember the dad's name?
Lewis.
And she was there with Ellie and the parents, you know, the actual grandparents were in the background, whatever. They're all just doing whatever. There is a painting and that painting shows a little boy in an old, oh God, I wouldn't even know the era, but a blue velvet outfit. It almost looks like a dress with, you know, slouchy pants. Some black.
Oh, and Gage is dressed like that, right?
That's how Gage was dressed for the funeral. And
I did notice that, like, in the back of my mind, if I didn't pay attention to it up front.
I noticed it. I made sure to point it out, and I told, you know, Antonio, I was like, hey, look at this. I was like, and remember that photo. There's also a gray cat in the photo. Everything's there.
We did the Victorian funeral tour of my old Kentucky home last night. Mm-hmm. Done it before, but it's always cool to, it's been years, so it's cool to do a refresher. The stuff they did was so creepy back in the day. Like, they had, and stuff that would cause hauntings, let's just put it out there. They had death masks they would make by pouring wax on the dead person's face because they couldn't take pictures of them. Okay. And then they would take, like, plaster, and then you would keep, like, this plaster mask of the dead person's face, like, in your house.
No big deal.
So when you brought flowers to the funeral, and you brought flowers to cover up the smell of the dead body because they didn't have, you know, a way to, preserve them, you also brought a lock of your hair, whether you're a man or woman, because the widow or some female in the family would take the flowers and take the hairs and weave them together. And over the course of their grieving period would make like little, design trinkets or whatever that they would hang up. So there's literally, and they had this in my old Kentucky home. They had like one of the family members died. There was a hair like wreath that they made from all these people that attended the funeral that, you know, to honor the memory.
Interesting. Like, what if you start, like,
you know, from Supernatural that locks of hair is keeps spirits around.
Yes. And that's the thing, is like, okay, well, like, what if you got like multiple funerals to attend and you're just tired of cutting off your hair, you know?
Well, and it would have been a big time back then because there was 9 people in that family that died all in the course of a week because they got cholera infected water and they died within 3 days.
There we go.
And the last thing that they had that was simple. I mean, it was all kinds of stuff like that. It was just like one thing after, but they also had like in one of the bedrooms upstairs, their infant, because they didn't have like photographers at the time, their infant had passed away. So they had hired somebody to come in and draw a sketch of their dead infant. And that's what they had hanging up was the sketch of their dead infant.
Crazy.
On November 2nd, 2020, Mary Lambert confirmed through Twitter that the DVDs and Blu-rays do not include the deleted scenes as extra because they are lost.
So
that is shit.
Are they on, like, do they exist on cassette?
I don't know that they exist on anything because they didn't put extras on VHSs because they didn't have space.
Yeah. Damn.
During the opening credits, there are several children's voices reciting epitaphs from the deceased pets. One of those voices belongs to Jonathan Brandis, who starred as the young Bill Denborough in another of Stephen King's most popular works, It, from 1990.
Nice.
Except for the fact that, if I'm recalling right, Jonathan Brandis died at a very young age.
I will confirm. I believe he is dead. I didn't think it was at a young age, but continue.
I'm pretty sure it was like he died at the age of like 14 or 15 if he got that old. It was right after Ladybugs, if I remember right, that he passed away. This was the first film screenplay that Stephen King adapted from one of his own novels. Mary Lambert dragged the crew all over Maine to find various geographic difficulties to include in the trek to the old Indian burial ground. Which makes sense. Over the years, critics have frequently voiced concern over the impression that being in this film must have left on that it must have affected Miko Hughes. On the contrary, his parts during the horror scenes were shot separate from the more disturbing elements and violent action, and he was later edited into these scenes while a child dummy was used during the more intense action footage.
Yes.
So that's how you get away with not messing him up.
Jonathan Brandis died at the age of 27. Suicide.
Wow. I thought he died earlier than that, but I'm probably confusing with somebody else. Mm-hmm. Fred Gwynn's hair was actually black, so he dyed his hair white on a regular basis during the role of Judd Crandall. That's crazy to think that. It just looks natural in this movie.
Yeah.
When Mrs. Creed hitches a ride with a trucker after her car problems, did you realize this? Did you realize what the truck's number was?
Wait, reread that again. What's going on?
When Rachel hitches the ride with that trucker that you said was one that hit Gage. After she has the car problems, the truck's number is 666.
I didn't realize that now.
This is the debut film for Miko Hughes. He was only 31 to 33 months during the production.
Fuck.
The tree that Ellie Creed swings on after first arriving at their new home made such an impression on Mary Lambert and Stephen King that they dug it up from a field where they spotted it and replanted it in front of the house.
Wow.
They had searched all summer for the perfect house with a tree and never found it, so this was their compromise.
Oh, shit.
They shot the film in Maine because it was Stephen King's contract that production would take place there. Mary Lambert says it worked out beautifully, though, as the landscape has iconic quality and archetypal resonance, according to her. The cat's glowing eyes were done in camera. Cats, as it turns out, have a retina that reflects light. Not a lot of animals have this, but cats do. The film just put a light directly above the camera lens so that when they were shooting with the cats, it would reflect off, you know, into the camera and show that, you know, perfection. That look.
Yeah.
One of the things that draws Mary Lambert to horror is the genre's opportunity to make up your own rules as a filmmaker. According to her, you can create a world that exists with its own set of rules. You can ignore physics, but the only thing you have to do is then adhere to those rules. She says Pet Sematary does a great job establishing and following its own rules.
Okay.
The Mi'kmaq burial ground in the film was constructed upon an actual mountaintop. According to director Mary Lambert, bulldozers were brought in to build the stone mounds.
Damn.
The only two songs in the credits are by the Ramones. And again, that's because Mary Lambert worked with them. They had to shoot Pascal's Don't Make Me Tell You Twice scene twice. He had to tell him twice. It was felt that Dale Midkiff looked too sexy. He was sleeping shirtless. There's this whole thing about him in this movie that they didn't want, that like they thought that his shirtless scenes would like distract the audience from the horror that was supposed to be, or the, you know, what was supposed to be portrayed on the screen. So they had to go out of their way to make him look dumpy in those scenes when he's walking around Pascal so that the females in the audience wouldn't be like, what?
Oh, what? My God. What? He was not that sexy. Calm down.
That's literally what their argument was. I'm serious about this.
He's not an ugly guy, but he wasn't like mind-blowingly sexy, you know?
Director Mary Lambert spoke about the costume worn by Gage that was painted especially for the movie. Marlene Stewart, my costume designer, designed the costume we were going to put Gage in at the end of the movie. We had the artist paint the child in that costume. Mm-hmm. Earlier in the flashback, you'll notice that Zelda is in that costume too. It's creepy because it's in the painting of a dead child dressed as an adult in a fancy clothing that reflects reality. I was trying to plant the connection between Gage and Zelda subliminally in the movie.
Interesting.
The scene where Pascal first visits Lewis in the night was originally shot with star Dale Midkiff clad only in his jockey shorts, as Lewis described in the novel. However, the scene was reshot with him wearing full pajamas because filmmakers were concerned that his attractive physical appearance would diminish the eeriness of the scene.
Okay, but were those even pajamas? They look like scrubs.
It's just funny, and it adds to the stereotype, you know, of like waspy white people that, the, you know, like they... Like, we all sleep in these, like, flannel, like, you know, full-length pajamas, and, you know, we have robes and stuff, and it's just like, no, but okay. Yeah. I mean, in the movies we do. I mean, apparently you're too sexy if you're wearing, you know, what you would normally wear to bed. So there you go. During the film, the character Judd, played by Fred Gwynn, mentions that he had a pet named Spot. Spot was also the name of the pet dragon on Gwynn's TV show, The Munsters.
Aww.
The opening title sequence with credits over images of handmade headstones in a pet cemetery came straight from Stephen King's script. Several seconds of gruesome footage had to be cut to avoid an X rating, including the scene where Gage bites into the neck of Judd.
Fucking bullshit.
Tom Savini turned down the chance to direct this film. That would have been interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
By the way, I saw the new uncut version of Night of the Living Dead 1990. Pretty good. Pretty good. It's funny because watching it, I didn't notice that many differences from the original movie, but the one that stands out the most is there is an extra scene for sure where the big fat zombie gets up and, Barbara attacks it. You see more of that because it explains why, you know, or cause it, there's a quick cut in the original movie that kind of makes no sense, like how it got to where it was at, but it shows how it got there in the new one. So
no.
In the film, Judd and some of the friends set the Baderman house on fire, killing Bill and the resurrected Timmy in the process. In the novel, Bill Baderman shot Timmy with a shotgun and then set his own house on fire, killing himself in the process.
And that's where I was like, this doesn't seem right. I thought he did it, but okay, now I understand why I remember that.
When Victor Pascal is being carried in the clinic after being hit by a truck, foreshadowing, a rabies poster with a picture of Cujo can be seen on the bulletin board by the stairs.
Wait. Okay, but what? Shut the fuck up. I need to watch that again.
The idea for this story came when Stephen King's daughter's cat, Smucky, was killed on the highway outside their home. Smucky's name appears on gravestones in the pet cemetery in both the film and the novel. The story was inspired by actual events that Stephen King experienced while living in Arlington, Maine with his family. King recalled that while living there, his daughter's cat was killed on the highway, much like Ellie Creed's emotional outburst was taken from King's own grief-stricken daughter. King also remembered that once his youngest son had nearly ran into the road while a truck was speeding down it, much like Gage does in the film. The character Judd Crandall was based on his elderly neighbor that lived across the road at that time, and there was an actual pet cemetery in the woods behind his house, which became the basis for one of the novel.
Nice.
That setup is, yeah, I could see why that would make, you know, this story, basically. Judd Crandall's house for the film was actually a facade built upon a smaller pre-existing house for the finale where the house is burned, and asbestos shield was constructed between the two houses so that while burning the facade, there would be no damage to the actual smaller house that it was built upon.
Nice.
When Church is killed for the second time as a climax, the needle's rigged look as if it's sticking in him, but it's not. The cat was sedated by a veterinarian. A representative of the Humane Society was present, and the cat made a full recovery. So there you go.
Yay!
Mary Lambert sees Victor Pascal as the good angel and Judd as the bad angel, as I've said. She says, as a friendly old man is the one that Lewis should be ignoring. His wardrobe, especially his large hooded jacket he's wearing when Church is found dead, is meant to suggest his darkness.
Yeah, okay.
The discussion as to how to present the zombie Gage on screen touched at one point on the possibility of using a little person. Instead, they wisely settled on a combination of real Miko and a puppet. Anytime there was blood, that was the puppet because the film crew didn't want to traumatize young Miko. Aww. So there you go. The portrait of Zelda as a child also features a gray cat at the child's feet and obvious foreshadowing in another sense. I do love that about this movie. There is foreshadowing
everywhere.
Every bit. They thought it through. For the scene where Lewis discovers Judd's body, a sculpture of Fred Gwynn's head was used rather than the actor himself. This is why the shot of Judd's body is so brief. They didn't want to, you know, like you'd realize it's like, oh, well, that's, you know, obviously not him.
Well, they did a really good job with that head.
They did. Just like Elvira, she gives good head. At 1509, as the house goes up in flames, Timmy Baderman shouts, "Love, Dead, Hate, Living." This line is originally from Bride of Frankenstein, as spoken by Boris Karloff as the monster. Timmy repeats the line a minute or so later.
Wow.
It's also funny that they quote something from Frankenstein, considering they had Fred Gwynn, who was obviously a knockoff. In the novel, Rachel passed a sign for Salem's Lot, showing that the two are connected.
Oh, wow. I mean, a lot of the his towns are based off of Maine, so it makes sense.
There's a lot of his novels that are either around, they mention Derry, which is where it's from. They mention Castle Rock. There's a ton of them that mention Castle Rock because a lot of his stories are set there. And there's several that mention Salem's Lot. Mostly Salem's Lot's mentioned as like a boogeyman type thing because the vampire that basically destroyed that town, like anytime somebody's anywhere near Salem's Lot, they kind of shudder and they just kind of like go somewhere else, you know. In the book, there are several callbacks to Stephen King's The Shining, some of which carry over into the film. Victor Pascal calls Lewis Doc, which was Danny Torrance's nickname. And throughout the film, it's shown that the Creed family suffer from nightmarish visions and premonitions, implying that they all have the Shining ability.
The Shinning.
What, you want to get sued? The Shining is a metaphysical mechanic that Stephen King has utilized in many of his books subsequently to that one as part of a shared literary universe. Yeah, basically, if you read the Gunslinger series, the Dark Tower, later on, he works that The Shining is being used by the, I can't remember the name of the bad guy in the Dark Tower, but like the main bad guy in the Dark Tower to break the tower down. So they actually kidnap people with the Shining ability and use them to break the barrier.
Damn.
According to Mary Lambert, the scalpel handled by the undead Gage wasn't sharp. I would hope not. I mean, exactly, you don't want to give And then when Church was found dead alongside the highway, a fake cat was used. I got to say, though, when they peel that dead cat up off of the grass, it is pretty gross.
Yes, they did a good job. Yeah. I mean, that's ultimately what my cat looked like when she passed. I picked
this movie as far as the review goes. What do you think?
I'm sorry, you said what now?
Go ahead and give your review first because I picked this movie, so I want to go last on this one.
Okay. Well, I have discovered something recently about what makes we score 5 out of 5, you know, not 5 out of 5. We score out of 5 points. And I was discussing this with a boyfriend last night and I said, there is one very simple rule I have. And I think it's very, very basic. Now, granted, we put a lot into the reviews. We discuss what we liked about this, what we liked that, blah, blah, blah. But ultimately at the end of all of that, what is going to give this movie a good score is, what would I have done to change this movie? Would I have added anything? Would I have taken something away? Would I have changed anything? What is it? And when I cannot figure out something fairly quickly, or even after pondering what I would change, this movie's getting a 5 out of 5.
So I assume that this is a 5 out of 5 for
you. That's
what
I'm saying. That's exactly. This movie is a 5 out of 5. There is nothing I would have changed about this film. For its time, everything held up and even better. Granted, yes, we talked about one scene of him flying from the attic. Wouldn't change that because it's part of the film now. And it's really not something they had to do better at that time.
Yeah, just jumping in my own, I would say 5 out of 5 too, because this movie scared me when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And the older I get, the more I rewatch it, I know I'm in for a bad time when I watch this movie in a good way. Not in a sense of it's a bad movie. It's just like when I'm watching it, it's dread the entire movie, because I know it's like it goes from bad to worse. And the thing about this movie is what you're afraid of changes based upon what stage of life you're in, which is amazing when you think about it, because when you're young, Pascal can scare you. He scared me a little bit as a kid. When you get older, you realize he's actually a good guy. Yes. So his image is bad, but he's comforting actually when you get, older. Zelda kind of stays scary no matter what, just because it's so creepy. But the idea of losing Gage when you get older and you get to the age where you can have children or do have children, that becomes so much more of the reason why as an adult that this movie hits you harder.
It really
it
does.
It grows with you.
And not only that, you find yourself being like, get the baby, get the baby. But you know, he's not going to get the baby. But the desperation that I felt when it's like, just get the baby. You're right there. And then he falls and you're like, you're going to watch your child die. You know, it's bad. So yes. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because yes, you actually almost look forward to Pascal. You're like, please, Pascal, help. Help us, Obi-Wan.
He's the moment in the movie that gives you a little bit of if he's going to give you any hope in this movie, it's when Pascal's on screen.
Oh, yes, 100%.
But when you're a kid and you see him, you're like, you're scared out of your goddamn mind. Like, you're like, I don't know what I'm seeing. I don't know why this guy's here. The fucking cat is scary. Like, you know, it just kind of depends. But the older you get, you realize that he really is. He sees what's going to happen to Lewis, and he's trying his best. And there's just, and one thing after the other just fails. Like, and it's just, and I think that's why this movie stands up. I mean, again, there's not a whole lot of visuals that they use in this movie, but the ones that they used are effective enough that it still stands up even this day.
There's not a lot, but what they use counts. And that is what literally counts. That's what matters. I do want to bring up something real quick that is important that we don't get to bring up a lot on this season, not only because we had some drawbacks, but because not every animal movie we reviewed, you can discuss this, because I feel like with werewolves, it's not something, but we need to discuss, was Church a bad boy? Was Winston Churchill a bad boy? A certified bad boy or a certified good boy?
The undead version, certified bad. I mean, there's nothing good about that cat.
What did he do that made him bad? In the movie.
Actually, he's the reason that Judd died. Now, that could be a good thing if you really feel like Judd deserved it, and he kind of did at that point. Mm-hmm. But if he hadn't distracted Judd, Judd would not have been, I mean, Gage wouldn't have got the upper hand on Judd like he did.
Okay, and that's, I think that's a very good point in that. It, and it's crazy because it's one of those things where he technically didn't do anything. It's a gray area. He did with Judd for sure. But prior to that, he didn't do anything to anyone else in the family, other than a few scares here and there.
Well, he scratched Lewis, but I mean, it was Lewis's cat at that point. So, yeah. I mean, and Lewis was the reason why the cat was bad. So that was on him at that point.
Yes. Now, I give you a hard time because I always think all the animals are good. Boys are good girls. Winston Churchill was indeed a bad kitty when it came back. But I will say this. My client is innocent because my client did not ask to come back and was forced against his will. He did not ask to come back.
That is not his fault. I will agree with you wholeheartedly on that.
He was forced to be a bad boy. So I
would argue the same thing with Cujo, though. Yes. Cujo was bad, but it wasn't his fault because he was a good dog until he got rabies. He was
very much a good boy.
You know, so it's I don't know if that's a king thing where like the evil creatures, I mean, you know, in particular, like the animals are not really evil because they, you know, they got mm-hmm. circumstances that led to it, but I will give them in that case. I mean, like that neither one of them, it was their fault, like correct. At all.
I officially declare Winston Churchill misunderstood.
I will accept that for this one, because it, unlike you trying to argue that the cyborg dog, which again, it was operated on, but from Man's Best Friend or whatever that movie was called, mm-hmm. that dog was fucking raping other dogs and doing all kinds of stuff. There was nothing good about it. And you tried to argue
it's
hard
his animal that... instinct.
It was a little bit more than that, but we'll let that slide.
He's got that dog in him.
Literally, yeah. But yeah, 5 out of 5. If you sit there and say that this movie doesn't scare you, then maybe it's because but I don't know how you can watch this movie and not have something in this bother you. Mm-hmm. Like literally you have to, I mean, if you're old enough to where it, and you watch it for the first time, then at least the stuff with Gage dying and how it's handled mm-hmm. afterward should bother you. It yes. should.
I will give, you know, the listeners this, that, you know, you're desensitized because you've watched so much, you know, so many scary movies. I am not desensitized. I thank the Lord every day that I still get scared by the dumbest shit. Is the funnest thing in the world to be scared. I love it. However, that being said, if you watch this movie, you don't have to be scared per se. You do need to be disturbed at minimum.
I would argue that this movie still gets you, fills you with dread mm-hmm. at certain then it's doing its part, because I'll even give you a scene, and it goes back to because they didn't have the budget, but it worked anyways. When Lewis and Judd were walking up that hill, and you know that the Wendigo is pretty mm-hmm. close to them, it's creepy as fuck mm-hmm. the way that they did in the movie. It really is. The sound and everything else, the way that you know, Fred Gwynn reacts to it, I mean, it's creepy.
Yes. So watch the movie, guys. Enjoy the movie. And if you don't want to be scared, that's fine, but you minimum have to be bothered or disturbed. So,
yep. And with that, peace be with you.
And with your spirits.